Support for NPR podcasts comes from Visa, offering the Visa Signature Card, featuring concierge services for travel, dining, and entertainment at visasignature.com.
This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A little bit later in the hour, we'll have an AIDS update. But first, perhaps no other hot, parched piece of Earth is more famous than the Sahara Desert. Sandy, barren, desolate, it's straight out of central casting for deserts. But it wasn't always so. Once a green Sahara, it went on to become the world's largest hot desert. So just how did the Sahara dry out? The consensus has been that a climate shift happened quite rapidly, but a new study out this week in the journal Science says the change happened more slowly. Researchers studying the climate record stored in lake sediments in northern Africa were able to reconstruct the shift from savanna to Sahara. And the head of the research team joins us now with that story. He's also here to tell us about another ancient lake whose remains lie under the sands of the Sahara, whether there's still water there today, and if so, could it be tapped for drinking water for the people of North Africa? If you'd like to join our discussion, our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Stefan Kropelin is a geoarchaeologist and a senior research scientist in the Africa Research Unit in the Institute of Prehistoric Archaeology at the University of Cologne. And he joins us today by phone from his office there. Welcome to the program.
Hello, how are you?
Thank you for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
So this is hard, I think, for people to believe that the Sahara Desert was once this green, nice, filled with trees and plants place.
Yes, in fact, that was the case. That was after the end of the last ice age, when the global temperature rose, there was increasing evaporation over the oceans and the intensification of the monsoonal system, and that brought humidity and clouds far into the interior of the continents and turned it more or less green. That's mm-hmm. why we talk for the period, between 8,500 and 5,300 BC of a green Sahara, which was really a lush environment with very favorable living conditions for prehistoric people, with lots of wildlife ranging from elephants and giraffes to hippopotamus and crocodile, and a very lush grass savanna in the northern half of the Sahara, and a very well-developed tropical savanna flora in the southern half of the Sahara.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have a new theory about how that all changed to become the desert. Is that correct?
Yes, more or less. I mean, as you know, I'm a geologist, and I just can read ancient deposits, mostly from ancient lakes, and tell how the environment and the climate has changed. To ask about the reasons behind the climate change, you would have to ask an astronomer. But in fact, of course, the most accepted theory these days, or for many years now, is that most scientists believe that this change is caused by orbital forcing. That means a change in the summer insolation of the sun on the continents, and this has changed, or this has decreased, since the beginning of the wet phase after the end of the last glaciation. And so, in fact, it's probably most of all orbital forcing. That means the astronomical factors which have had the result that we had a humid phase in the Sahara about every 100,000 years during the past 2 million years.
Mm-hmm. Could that change have caused the migration of people to perhaps create the culture in northern Africa, in Egypt, the pyramids, things like that?
Yes, exactly. That was our result of a paper also published in Science 2 years ago, where we had said, where we claim that the climate-controlled desiccation of the Sahara can be considered as a motor of Africa's evolution to the present day, because when the conditions became drier, so there was no choice for the prehistoric people. Either they could have stayed and died because of lack of water, or they could have moved on. So mobility was the key for survival, and that's either they went They approached the Nile Valley, bringing all mm-hmm. their culture and technology and know-how, so really helped to found the pharaonic civilization in the Nile Valley, all the way continuing the southward retreating rains to where they are today, for example, in Darfur.
Could there still be water under all those sands there in the Sahara?
Of course, there is still lots of water. There are even much more water than was believed before. But in the end, the question is at what depth and where. And the problem with all the water under the Sahara is that it's all fossil water that was recharged for the last time during the early Holocene. That means around 12,000 to 5,000 years ago, roughly. And this was the rainfall which penetrated into the sandstone and refilled this aquifer. So using it today for no matter which purposes means groundwater mining. That means you can extract it like petroleum, but then it's gone until the next humid phase, which usually normally would come only in about 60 to 80,000 years. That means groundwater under the desert, and especially under the Saharan desert, is very, very precious and should only be used for very specific purposes.
How much water, how many years' worth of water is there under there? Or how much population could it support for how long?
Well, we have calculated, or my colleagues who did groundwater modeling have said that, for example, the new schemes which are developed in Egypt in the what is called the New Valley in this Oasis Depression west of the Nile, and where hundreds of thousands of people are moved to from the overcrowded Nile Delta and Nile Valley, that all this towns will become ghost town in no later than 30 or 40 years. That means it's a very limited supply. Theoretically, there's much more water under the Sahara, but this would mean that you would have to dig a drill hole, boreholes, to extract the water in equidistant positions, and you would have to do thousands of them and then link them by a pipeline to extract all the water. Because every well you use, once you extract the water for a year, then you have a groundwater depression, and so the surrounding sandstone falls dry, and so you cannot use this drill hole anymore, and you have to get another one. So again, the water is too precious to be used for agricultural purposes like this. And the only hope for the future is, well, a very much developed industrial ocean seawater desalinization, because this mm-hmm. is a resource which will be there eternally.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to your paper for a second, and the main point, which was that the changes that created the desert happened a lot more slowly than other people had believed. What evidence and what are you using to base that belief on?
The first evidence, which we already presented this 2 years ago in science, this is, well, that we were using man as a very sensitive climate indicator. That means prehistoric people, the movement of prehistoric people who once lived during the humid period all over the Sahara, and then starting 5,300 BC, started moving very slowly southward, following the retreating rainfall. And so this is the archaeological evidence. And now to give the geological picture, to tell the geological story, we now have this core taken in the remote lake in northeastern Chad, in the center of the central, in the south of the central Sahara, which is persisting to the present day because it's supported or fully sustained by this outflowing fossil groundwater there. And there we have the last 6,000 years at a very high temporal resolution. That means we can count the different layers year by year, season by year, season back to 6,000 years ago. And there again, analyzing the pollen content, that means the plant remains and spores, we found out that over these past 4,000 years, there was a very slow decline in the vegetation cover, and there was a change from quite demanding tropical tree species to more and more aridity-resistant species until finally the whole area became completely void of vegetation as it is today.
How green was it? How many lakes, and what would it look like today if we were to picture it, you know, as it pictured years ago?
Well, if you want to have a comparison, for example, you always have to look to the environment which exists today about 800 kilometers south of the position during prehistoric times. And if you want, for example, to compare the ancient environments along the Wadi Hawa, which was one of the largest tributary to the Nile, which is situated between 17 and 18 degree latitude, then you go down, say, to central or southern Kordofan in Sudan, and the best is you go into a protected area, that means in a national park or so, where the vegetation hasn't been degraded because of overuse by the people there, and then you find about the same environments, which is permanent lakes with lots of fish in it, with all kinds of amphibious fauna, and surrounded by relatively dense tree savanna.
Let me ask you this question, because we're running out of time, and people wanted to know. I got a question from Second Life, from Lord Gynard, wanted to know, if you pumped water back in the Sahara, could it be green again? Is the soil fertile enough there, or is it just all sand blowing around?
Yes, no, not at all. The soil is much more fertile than you would think. You really, in fact, do not need more than water to make it green again. But, of course, where to take the water to fill up this very deep sandstone basins? So this might be a futuristic approach. Maybe one day groundwater or ocean water desalinization becomes that cheap, then this could be done. But for the time being, and certainly the next decades, this is unfortunately not an option.
Well, Dr. Kraupelin, I'd like to thank you for taking time, staying up late in Europe, and joining us on Science Friday.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
You're welcome. Stefan Kraupelin is a geoarchaeologist and senior research scientist at the Africa Research Unit in the Institute of Prehistoric Archaeology. That's at the University of Cologne in Germany. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, switch gears and talk about the AIDS. It's the 25th anniversary of the HIV virus. They didn't call it that back then. 25 years ago, when the French isolated the virus. So stay with us. We'll talk about the progress, the future, the hopes and the disappointments in the war against HIV. So stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation, Science Friday from NPR News.